But the Greeks were independent city-states, and they had a similar Greek culture, but they were quite different. And it was Athens that supplied what became the core of Greek culture. Alexander the Great sort of forced the Greeks together, creating an empire, and now they became Greeks. They became Hellenes, and that was their identity. And he went out and he conquered the Persian Empire. What we have here is a rough map of the Persian Empire and how Greek conquered that. Now, what's interesting, the Greeks had such a small army. When they conquered this area, it's not how we usually think of an empire conquering another place and occupying it. They couldn't occupy it. So what they would do is they would simply leave a contingent of Greeks to rule over the major cities and to bring Greek culture to those people. So sprinkled now throughout this empire are these Greek cities. When Alexander the Great died, it all began to contract down very quickly because they really didn't control it. And it just went, but the Persians didn't control it either. They became independent countries. But sprinkled throughout here was Greek culture. And it's especially true in a couple of places. One is Babylon, one is Judah, and one is Egypt. Now, we talk about Alexandria, Egypt. We will keep coming back to Alexandria, Egypt, because it was a center of Greek culture. Now, the Romans come along, and they conquer the empire. And when they conquer the empire, we see the Roman Empire, which is actually in numbers of people much larger than the Persian or the Greek Empire. But notice, it moves to the west. Oh, they have Babylonia, they have Asia Minor, which is Turkey, they have Greece, they have Rome, and of course you see little pieces of Spain here. They had Spain, they had Gaul, which is now France, they had little pieces of Germania. Eventually, it would move east and it would split into two empires, the east and western side of the empire. They would never take Media and Persia. They would never move that far. It was because they always ended up in wars with those people, and they always ended up in stalemates. And they never conquered those areas. But this area now is much more people, and something very interesting happens. When the Romans conquer Greece, they're so inspired with Greek culture that they basically hijack it. They take everything Greek they can get their hands on. They do this a little bit to Egypt too. And they take it to Rome. And they spread Greek culture throughout the Roman Empire. It becomes, as I said before, the language of commerce. You know, everybody knows Greek. You speak your native language, but everybody knows Greek. You think Latin, which is what the Romans speak, would be the main language. And it's not. Greek becomes the main language. And sprinkled throughout here is this Greek culture that the Romans adapt, and they emulate the Greeks. So let's talk a little bit about now the culture of Rome. The culture of Rome. We see how large the empire was, and in numbers, it was just between 60 and 80 million people here in the time of the first century when Jesus is born. The emperor when Jesus is born is Augustus. Rome had originally been a republic, and that means that it had a Senate, and the members of the Senate represented their areas. Now, that doesn't mean they were voted into power. They were put into power by the rich people in different areas. But at least it was some kind of representative government. Remember, the Athenians had created democracy. The Romans had no interest in democracy. What they did have an interest in originally was a republic. And in this republic, there was at least representatives that came from all over the empire, came in, and they represented their areas. Well, Julius Caesar didn't like that, and he tried to make himself the emperor, and they killed him. But Augustus, his nephew, took over and became the first real emperor. And the time of Jesus, Augustus was the sole ruler. Now, he had a Senate, and he had to sort of do what they say sometimes, but basically the power was now in the emperor. And Augustus expanded the empire. He expanded Greek culture. He expanded this new mixture also of Roman culture into it. Understanding what Rome itself was is important, because Rome was the biggest, by far, the biggest city in the world. People were shocked. A city of 1 million people was beyond comprehension. You know, Jerusalem wasn't that big, and Jerusalem was one of the biggest cities in the world. But when Josephus, remember we talked about Josephus, when he showed up and saw Rome, he went back and said, "We can't win the war, folks. You have no idea the power these people have, the wealth they have." And Rome itself was a mixture of incredible riches and wealth and incredible poverty. And that created a very interesting culture that was different than, this is in some of the ways they were different than the Greeks. How many of you have ever seen the Pantheon? It's amazing. The reason it's amazing is because how in the world do you design? Now, it's easy for us today. We can design domes easily. How do you come up with the idea of a dome? There's no central structure in there. Why does it not collapse? And they figured out how to build a dome and so that they could take the stress and weight and put it out over an area and it would hold itself. It's just remarkable. And it still stands today. Now, the obelisk out front is from Egypt because the Romans not only plundered Greece, they plundered Egypt. And they took everything they could grab and took it back to Rome. But you see what they did in terms of aqueducts. And here's something that the Romans did. Greek architecture is amazing, but Roman engineering is what's amazing. They still stand today. And you can go throughout Italy and find all these aqueducts. So they would take a small town of 5,000 people, build an aqueduct so water could come into the town because it didn't have much of a water source, and it would grow to 20,000 people. The Roman Empire did a lot of good for a lot of people. It's just they did it with total control of you either do it our way or we squash you. But at the same time, you'll be surprised when we go through this how much freedom people had. You had freedom of religion. Freedom of speech, as long as you didn't say anything against the emperor. There was a lot of freedom. But if you did not like their ways, they would crush you. Rome itself, they built amazing buildings. Now, I've seen the ruins here. This is the Circus Maximus in outside the Forum in old downtown Rome. And the ruins of this, they built, and one of the things they did were games. Now, remember the Greeks, everybody was an athlete. You know, and they all competed. I say everybody. It was a male-dominated society. So the men were all athletes. And the men would go and compete at the Olympic Games every 4 years. And all the city-states would get together to have their games. The Romans took gaming to a whole new level. And there's a number of reasons for this. But the Circus Maximus was where they would have these incredible circus races. How many of you have seen the movie Ben-Hur? The old Ben-Hur. Okay. What's amazing about the old Ben-Hur, even if you don't watch the rest of the movie, watch the chariot race. That was before computer graphics. That means they actually do the chariot race. It was dangerous. People got really hurt filming that. So if you don't ever see the movie, at least watch the chariot race. You can go YouTube and see, you know, Ben-Hur chariot race. Watch that chariot race. Because that's as closest as you're ever going to see to an actual what a chariot race was like. There were no rules, and people died all the time. I'm always amazed at old movies before they had CGI. I mean, they actually had to do things. Like, if you had needed 5,000 people in the scene, you got 5,000 people, and you paid them a little bit of money, and they were in the scene. Because that's the only way you could do it. You just didn't keep reproducing the same faces over and over again. They became the greatest consumer society in the world. Because all wealth came to Rome. They had set up a system where they controlled the Mediterranean Sea. The Mediterranean Sea was filled with pirates. And the Roman Navy is what saved everybody from pirates. So if you were a merchant, all the people who were business people loved the Roman Empire. Free trade all over the place. They liked free trade. Because free trade meant there was more tax money to collect. So they wanted everybody to make money. Everybody make money, and we pay, and then we get the taxes. So all taxes eventually ended up in Rome. One of the reasons the Roman Empire fell is they had no concept of inflation. They actually created so much money it became worthless. Because every town made money. Every province made money. Rome itself made money. Everybody made money. I mean, actually made money. they had coinage, and they would make money. So everybody made their own money. Copper coins, silver coins, and gold coins. They eventually made so many copper coins that they created such inflation that they became worthless. They had no idea, but everybody's making money, isn't this good? So literally every town would say they'd created a smelting place and they would make their own coins. Good, we're making more money. Pay your taxes. And it's one of the reasons they collapsed their economy in the 5th century. But they were a great consumer society. That's why they became a place of both wealth and poverty. Imported food became inexpensive. That meant when Rome first started, there was a huge agricultural system throughout Italy. To feed 1 million people was a huge undertaking back then. I mean, you plowed your field with a donkey. Okay? So they had just thousands and thousands of farmers. And these farmers made good money by feeding Rome. Plus, you had the Roman army, which was marching all over the place, and they had to try to feed them. Of course, they would eat off the land, but you also had to send food with them and so forth. So these farmers did very well until someone figured out, you know what? We can make this more efficient by taking the farms and making them one giant farm system run by the government. And they did. They became much more efficient. But now there were tens of thousands of farmers out of work. So they all moved to Rome. And now you have a huge areas of Rome just filled with poor people living in squalor and poverty. And a lot of them were the farmers that had lost their jobs. Because they got into Rome and there weren't any jobs. The reason there weren't any jobs is because of slavery. Now, in this country, slavery was basically a racial issue. It was not in Rome. They were equal opportunity slavers. They would enslave anybody they conquered. So if you were even a middle-class person, not just a rich person, or even sort of the lower middle class in Rome, you could own slaves. Now, you might have a slave from Hispania, Spain. You might have a slave from Germania. A German. Germans didn't tend to make good slaves. They made really good soldiers, though, but they didn't tend to make good slaves. They didn't like slavery. You might have a slave from Gaul, France, modern French people. You might have a slave from North Africa or Egypt, but you know who the most prized slaves were? Greeks. Not because they worked, because Greeks were brought in to teach your children. They didn't have public schools like the Greeks did. The Romans had private teachers for all the wealthy and middle-class families, and they were Greek slaves. And the Greeks taught them mathematics, and so they learned engineering. They taught them science, it taught them philosophy, and it taught them the Greek language. So if you were middle-class or upper-middle-class or wealthy in Rome, your children eventually, so after a couple generations, they not only spoke Latin, they spoke Greek because they were tutored. So you think Paul saying the law was a tutor to bring us to Christ. Now, what do we think of a tutor? You know, maybe some of you had a tutor for geometry, you know, because you were having trouble with geometry and you got a tutor to help you. That's not what they meant. A tutor was usually a Greek slave who came in and raised your child for you so that they were educated and they had class. And they were, you know, they were smart and they could play instruments and all the things the Greeks did, they taught them. So when he says the law was a tutor to bring you to Christ, it had a much greater meaning to those people than it means to us. So the Greeks were the most valued slaves because of that. Now, some very enterprising Romans took slaves, and they found the slaves that were, say, really good at working with bricks and stone. So they would buy a whole bunch of slaves that were good at bricks and stone. And then they would make them into a business. So you would contact this guy and say, I need some brickwork done on my house. No problem. My crew will show up tomorrow. But his crew wasn't like we think of a guy who owns a construction company, you know, and his employees show up. His slave showed up and worked. Now, this was a good job if you're a slave, you know, because they had to take care of you because you had to go out in public and do all this work and everything. And so they actually had businesses of slaves, which means these farmers coming in have no jobs. You actually have to sell yourself. So you have huge unemployment, which brings up a couple unique Roman things. And by the way, this poverty, this is a quote from a book, a very good book by Moses Hadas, who's a historian of ancient Rome. He talks about what it was like to live in the poverty sections of Rome. He says, in the days of Augustus, about 1 million people lived in Rome, most of them jammed into stuffy, malodorous apartments. They smelled so bad that Pliny was a famous writer from, you can find his writings online, suggested disguising the odor by burning bread. So people would burn bread to try to get the smell. Because, okay, you brought some animals with you from the farm. There's no barns in this city. Everybody's crammed in. I mean, the streets are so narrow, and sometimes they're 4 or 5 stories high, so your animals lived in your apartment with you. Rich people, middle-class people, lived in really nice houses, which had their own little center area, which was a garden. So your own house had a garden, and your own house had a fountain in it, where you know. But everybody else lived in apartments, with your animals in the apartments with you. So they smelled really bad. And if you lived in the really poor parts of Rome, people complained about housing shortage, soaring rents, congested traffic, polluted air, crime in the streets, and the high cost of living. Sort of like living in New York today. Except you're sort of free in New York today. You know, so what do you do with all these people? And they turn into what the Romans call the mob. In other words, every once in a while, they would just riot. You know, we're all hungry. They took our farms away. We're going to riot today. And they'd go around burning down places and rioting. So the Romans are like, okay, we got to do something with these farmers. We got to keep them busy. We will give them bread and games. So the poor people got to go into the games for free. And they usually got some food when they went in. And they could spend the morning watching gladiators hack themselves to death, eating some bread, and not worrying about the fact that they didn't have a job. The games was one of the ways of controlling the mob. Now, there was another thing they did that was the patron-client system. If you've ever, you know, Mr. McNeely and I both are, we like movies. Because, well, people hate watching movies with me because I'll be saying, wow, do you know how hard that camera shot is? You know, or things like that. And it's like, shut up, just get into the story. No, you got to understand what they're doing here. But I love the way movies are constructed. One of his favorite movies, if he's told you, is The Godfather. Pretty violent movie. How many have seen The Godfather? You know what's interesting about The Godfather? That's exactly what it was like to live in Rome. Because you had a patron. A patron was a wealthy man, and he walked through the streets, and he was wealthy because this was his area. His house was there, and he would walk through maybe a part of where the poor people were. And the poor people would come up and maybe get on their knees and kiss his ring and say, patron, patron, my family, they're sick, and I haven't had work in 2 weeks. And the patron would say, no problem. Here, give him a coin. Now, the next time the patron was having some political problems and he needed a good riot, he could go to all his people who he helped and said, I need a riot today. Or I need you to support me because Senator so-and-so is coming to visit me, so I need all of you out there clapping as he comes in. And so they would line the streets. You know, we don't care about Senator so-and-so, but patron said to do this, so, and he's the one that helps us, you know. Oh, I can give you some work today. Well, he gave me some work that one day. I didn't have any work. So they'd all line up and clap, and the senator would come and think, well, I'm a popular guy. No, the patron was setting it up. Of course, they all knew that too. It's the Godfather. So when they came to the United States, even though it's 2,000 years later, Italian neighborhoods tend to set themselves up the same way. They had a patron, they had a godfather, and everybody went to him when they needed help. He was very wealthy. And then he expected favors when he needed favors. That goes clear back to the Roman Empire. That's Rome. That's what it was. That's very unique, and it's not. There isn't quite other society anything quite like that. Family was very important to them, but they also lived in a very immoral society. Augustus tried to pass laws against things like adultery. Okay, I got to stop all this adultery going on. It's destroying our family. They were very family-oriented people. But what's also interesting is children were considered property until something very important happened. And that is the father picked the child up and accepted the child as his. If a woman was pregnant and the father did not want the child, the woman didn't have the authority to do this unless it was out of wedlock, he could order her to abort the child. Abortion was very, very common in Rome. So much so that women died in, they weren't very good at it, and women died in abortions. It's one of the reasons why the Roman army, at its height, when it was really, really good, they had two kinds of soldiers that fought real well in the Roman army. Now, that Spanish soldiers, French soldiers tend to fight well, but the Germans and the men from Rome themselves. And the one reason why there were so many men in the Roman army is because so many women died early, either because they had a dozen children and died in childbirth, or because of an abortion that got botched. There were so many more men than women. You know, usually in society, there's more women than men. There were so many more men than women, the only way they could go get a woman is join the army and go, you know, plunder someplace and grab a woman. So, abortion was common. They could decide to abort it before it was born. After it was born, it still didn't have rights yet until it was picked up by the father. If the father rejected the child, now remember in ancient Sparta, this is a weak boy, throw him out. And they literally would take the children out and just leave them in the country to die. The Romans, if a father didn't like the child for some reason, he was abandoned. They took him to a place in the city and they laid them down with other little crying babies and walked away. Hard place, Rome. And people would come along who couldn't have children and take a baby. If they lasted long enough, many of the babies died. Or people who trafficked slaves would come along and pick up the babies. And now they had a slave market. They just raised them as slaves. Now, it was common. That doesn't mean everybody did it. Not all Romans did this because they were very family oriented. But the flip side of this was abortion and abandonment happened of babies. The ancient world was a cruel world. There's no way to sanitize what it was like. Now, on the other side, they have a thing called adoption. In the Roman world, when you adopted somebody, you know, if you know somebody who was adopted, and you said, you know, oh, you were adopted. Yeah, I've been trying to find my biological parents. We still make a differential between the parents who adopted you and the biological parents, right? In the Roman world, they did not. If you were adopted, you were a full son or daughter. You had complete rights. Now, usually it was sons that were adopted. If a Roman thought his son was a real, you know, this guy's stupid, and I'm a wealthy man, and I'm going to give my wealth to him, but this guy over here, he's grown up in the neighborhood, I know him, he's a good family, and, you know, his parents died and he lost everything, so I'm going to adopt him and make him my heir. From that point on, he was his son. Not only legally, but emotionally, in the eyes of society, it was as if he was biologically his father. The idea of adoption was you were truly now part of the family. which is interesting when Paul talks about Christian adoption, because it was common for Jews to feel, or for Gentiles to feel like, well, the Jews are the true people of God, and we're sort of secondary Christians. And when he would say, you are adopted, okay, you weren't part of the physical seed of Abraham, but you are the spiritual seed of Abraham, and you are adopted. That had a power none of us can understand. Because it said to them, nope, you're exact children just like them. Okay, you're not physical seed of Abraham, but as the spiritual seed of Abraham, you're exactly in the mind of your father, you're exactly like them. See, we don't think of adoption. That's sort of weird. He said, you're adopted. No, to people in the Roman Empire, that meant an enormous thing. It means you're equal. You're equal. There's no concept that, oh, who's your biological parents? What's that mean? I am the son of this person. So adoption is a big thing in their society. Public baths are very big. Every place they went, they built public baths. Sometimes for women and men, sometimes together. Whole families would come together. Sometimes for the dating scene. I mean, public baths were a whole lot of reasons for public baths. But so partly dressed people or naked people bathing together was not that strange to them because they didn't have baths in their houses. Now, they did have some running water, but running water was not everywhere. In fact, one of the reasons why they think so many of the upper class of Rome had mental problems is they did have running water and they used lead pipes. And they think they all got lead poisoning. Because there seems to be an extra amount of mental illness among the upper class of Rome. And it could be because of lead poisoning, because they were using lead pipes. Now, they also adopted all the gods and goddesses of the Greeks. But they did something else. They kept their own gods. Any place they conquered, they accepted their gods. If you went to Rome, if you go to the Forum in ancient Rome, you will find temples to all different kinds of gods and goddesses. If you went to Pompeii, how many have been to Pompeii? They have a temple to Isis, which is an Egyptian goddess, right there in the center of Pompeii. Because the Romans didn't want to make any gods mad. The Romans never denied that Yahweh existed. They believe Yahweh existed and should be honored. What they couldn't figure out is, why do you think he's the only God? He's your God. Our God is obviously stronger. You know why? We conquered you, and your God couldn't stop us. That was their argument. But they never denied Yahweh. They just thought he was one of many gods. So, this is the Roman world. One thing they're really good at, though, we have to talk about this with the Romans. They are experts at war. Their infantry units create tactics that nobody else had ever seen. They're highly trained as individual fighters, but they fight as a unit. They fight as a unit. They are a professional army. When you go into the Roman army, you're in there for about 20 years. You're part of a professional army where you're highly trained. And you become very brutal army. They very good, you know, they had archers, they had cavalry, they had catapults, sort of a predecessor to later catapults, but they had something like a catapult. They had siege weapons. They had engineers. Remember I talked about Masada? They built a highway that had to be a mile long to get high enough to reach the top of a mountain. That means I had to bring all this dirt and figure out the angles and the geometry of it and everything, and that's how they destroyed and took Masada. They were experts at war, and they used their soldiers in a brutal way. In a brutal way. That's why there's in the book of Acts, there's a riot taking place with Paul, they're against Paul and so forth, and the governor comes out and says, stop this, because if we don't, Rome's going to hear about it. Now, they were under Roman rule, and they had all this freedom, and they had their own government, and they had all this stuff. But if Rome find out there was a riot, the next thing is a legion shows up and says, who caused the riot? You don't want that happening. So stop this now, because we don't want them showing up with soldiers. Because the one thing that the Romans wanted was order. Roman soldiers tended to be Stoics. Remember we talked about the Stoic philosophy of the Greeks? They tended to be Stoics. I mean, the leaders, not the average soldiers, which is a brute, a highly trained brute, highly intelligent, highly trained brute. But at the upper levels, they tended to be Stoics. High discipline, control. If there's anything's out of order, we squash it. So there's Rome for you. Now, Jesus comes into this world, right? Jesus comes into this world where he's in a Jewish society controlled by Rome with a partial Greek culture. And we're going to have to look and see where we will look at as the church formed, why even Greek culture inside of Judea affected the church. And so you have these three things coming together. The relationship between Jews and Romans was very interesting. Julius Caesar had a Jewish army help him one time in a battle. So he gave all kinds of special privileges to the Jews. Augustus carried that on, since it was his nephew, and he gave all kinds of special privileges to the Jews. It was illegal in a Roman court to force a Jew to come to court in a civil case. I mean, if he committed murder, it'd be different. In a civil case, you couldn't bring a Jew to court on the Sabbath. You had to wait to another day. All the Jewish synagogues were protected by law. Tithes and offerings given by Jews to the synagogue or to the temple were protected by law. In fact, they didn't even tax what went to the temple. The Jewish books, the scrolls, the Jewish Bible, Hebrew Bible, what we call the Old Testament, was protected by law. This allowed the synagogue system to grow. Remember we talked about the synagogues? Synagogues are growing all over the Roman Empire. So they sort of scattered because of the diaspora, and they scattered because of the Persians, but now the Romans, they just keep growing. Jews move to another city, they create a small community, they start businesses, they build a synagogue. A rabbi shows up. Now the problem is, most Jews now that are in the diaspora, have forgotten Hebrew. So the Bible now shows up in Greek. You have Greek copies of the Bible throughout the Roman Empire. Which, guess who also reads Greek? Gentiles. If you were going to take the gospel to the world, you couldn't take it to the world in Hebrew. Almost nobody spoke Hebrew. But you could take the gospel to the world in Greek. There's Greek Bibles all over the place. Wherever Paul shows up, there's Greek Bibles. And he can talk to the Gentiles, because it doesn't matter what their native language is. Many of them also speak Greek. You have to understand, part of what we're watching had to be maneuvered a little bit by God to make sure it's set up for the church to do its work in the midst of all this confusion of these empires. Tacitus, I mentioned Tacitus earlier, is one of our original sources. He writes that they just couldn't figure out who the Jews really were. They were so weird. They knew they came out of Egypt, but they thought they were kicked out of Egypt because they all had a weird disease from eating pigs. They couldn't figure it all out. And Moses was this guy who gave them a new religion, and that's what gave them hope, and that's what's kept them going. Others believed, well, okay, the Jews and this weird one God, they really worship the bull god, and there was a bull god, an Apis, in some pagan religions. And the reason why is they sacrifice bulls. And then there were some Romans that said, we figured it out, they worship Saturn. How in the world would you come to that conclusion? Anyone have an idea? How would you think that the Jews worship Saturn? The god Saturn.
Saturday.
They meet on Saturn day, yes. They meet on Saturn day. Saturday, as we call it today. That means they must worship Saturn. Oh, the Romans came to all kinds of crazy ideas. They would about the Christians too. Like the Christians are cannibals. Sure. Once a year they get together and they drink the blood of some guy. They're cannibals. We should kill these people. We don't want any cannibals in the Roman Empire. They couldn't figure these people out. But, so you have this very strange relationship. Seneca, who was a very famous philosopher and teacher, Roman, in Rome, actually taught Nero one of the, he was the teacher to Nero, one of the emperors. Seneca believed that the Jews were lazy because they wasted 1/7 of their life. The purpose of life is to be busy and do things and accomplish things, and the Jews just sit around and do nothing every seventh day. They're a bunch of lazy people. So that was his conclusion. So you have a really love-hate relationship. The Romans respect the Jews because they're an ancient civilization. And they have a temple, which is amazing architecture. And they have ancient scrolls and an ancient language. There was something conservative about the mindset, a political mindset of the Romans, in that they really liked ancient things. The older it was, the better it was. You know, no new ideas. And of course, wow, you existed before the Greeks. You got a crazy religion, but we really respect you for that. But you are weird. You're just strange people. We believe in your God. Why don't you believe in ours? We accept your God. We don't even tax your tithes. Come on. And the Jews were like, we don't even want to pay tithes. Remember what they asked Jesus? I mean, taxes. We don't want to pay taxes, you people. Remember what Jesus said? Pay your taxes. There's a lot of Jews who are highly offended by that. This rabbi said to pay your taxes. Well, this rabbi over here says not to. Remember, they argue over everything. So in the world where Jesus says, pay your taxes, because they asked him the question. Remember, they were asking him the question to trap him. If he says, don't pay your taxes, which like some of the rabbis are, we'll turn him in to the Romans. Here's a guy that's preaching insurrection. Don't pay your taxes. He took coins and said, who's on there? Caesar. Well, then give what he belongs to him. Well, we can't catch him on that one. Now, some Jews were offended. It was like, well, I don't want to pay taxes. Not to that evil empire. When you start to understand the history of it, you understand the reality they lived in. Jesus' arguments are brilliant. But he's arguing like a Jew in a Jewish world. So Jesus comes along. And remember, let's now look at Jesus as he's born into this world. He's born into a world in which everyday life is totally governed by the Messiah is coming, so we must protect the law. Therefore, the oral law, how we apply the law, must be exact. You know, in our church, we have oral law. We have ways we do things, and some of them are very good. And some of them, after a while, is like, why do we do that? I mean, why do we have to have 3 songs, a sermonette, 10 minutes of announcements, an exact hour sermon, and another song? Why? Well, because we're protecting the law. We're protecting the Sabbath. Well, okay. I have no problem with our way of doing things, but I change it up sometimes. And I like different music, too. I like special music. It's not just... Now, I also love classical music. I mean, if you want to sing the Hallelujah, of course, you can come sing it to my... but you got to be good at it. But, I really like... we had a guitar and some really sort of modern pop sacred music a couple weeks ago in Nashville. It was great. We don't have to, but you understand, why do we stick to the tradition? I understand. Because we have an oral law to protect the Sabbath. We're trying to protect the Sabbath. I'm not making fun of the Jews for what they did. I would have been a Pharisee. I'd have been doing everything I could do to protect the law. Okay, I understand where I would have fit in Jewish society if I'd have lived then, because that's the type of personality I have. But, after a while, I'd have been sort of a liberal Pharisee. Oh, come on, guys. No. Come on. We're just being, they said, well, the Essenes would have considered me an absolute heretic. Okay, so it just depends on which scale you're on. The Sadducees would have said, oh, you're too conservative for us. And the Pharisees would have said, you're too liberal for us. I'd have been somewhere in the middle. The Essenes would have said, burn him at the stake. Nah, because they didn't kill people. So here's the world Jesus comes into. But not only is he in this Jewish world, every day he sees Roman soldiers walking around, usually in pairs, because two German soldiers, or German, Russian, man, I'm tired. Two Roman soldiers. By the 4th century, by the way, most Roman soldiers were actually German. But anyways, at this time, a lot of them are Romans. In fact, there's an Italian company in Jerusalem. Because, remember, Peter goes to see a man who is of the Italian company. He's right from Italy. Now, that's why Peter didn't want to baptize him. Okay, I'll baptize anybody, any Gentile, but I'm not going to baptize some Roman. That's why he hesitated on baptizing. He's a Roman. God, I'll baptize, send anybody here. Egyptian, Ethiopian, somebody from Gaul. Send me a German. It doesn't matter. But I'm not going to baptize a Roman. He's having trouble here. But you always would see him walking in two because the zealots would attack him. Remember we talked about the zealots? Well, two of them could fight off some zealots. You know, one of them's bad, you know, because four or five of them jump in, you know, kill you. But Jesus grew up in a world where he knew Rome had the power. Yeah, there was the Sanhedrin. But if Rome ever got upset with the high priest, they'd just remove him. Not the Sanhedrin. This is the world he lived in. He grew up in this world. He grew up in a world where his parents told him, when you were a baby, we had to go to Egypt to hide because Herod decided to kill everybody because he wanted to kill you, so he killed all the children. He wasn't sure how old you were, so he killed even children older than you and younger than you. He just went through and killed all the little boys. They would have told him that story. And he could do so because why? I mean, Herod was not a Roman. Herod was an Edomian. Anybody know what an Edomian is? An Edomite. You know what an Edomite is? Descendant of Esau. They were cousins to the Jews. He was a cousin. But he was a cruel man. And he kept his power because the Romans gave it to him, and he was so afraid of a Messiah coming along that he killed the babies. He knew this. This is what he was told, even as a child, before he fully understood who he was. These are the stories. This is the world he came into. So Jesus now comes along, starts his ministry, and the first thing he does is he slaps the Pharisees right in the face. Then he slaps the Sadducees in the face. I don't think the Essenes, you know, you don't see the Essenes mentioned because I think the Essenes were like, forget him. I don't think they interacted with him. Although there is a school of thought that thinks that Jesus was an Essene. I don't think so. The Essenes were much more into the oral law. What Jesus shows over and over again is there's a problem in the interpretation of the law because it's based on the oral law. The Corban vow, which I talked about yesterday. The Sabbath. You know, you're healing on the Sabbath. You're working. But aren't you supposed to do good on the Sabbath? Well, they didn't argue that because that was a rabbinical argument. The ox in the ditch argument. That was what the rabbis used to make a point. Oh, yeah, well, okay. Yeah, a lot of the rabbis say what he's saying. There's other things he said that some would agree with and some would not. What's interesting, though, is he does something that no other rabbi would have done. And you see it in the Sermon on the Mount. You've heard it said that it's wrong to murder. But we also know it's wrong to hate somebody. That's not what he says. You have heard that it's wrong to murder. I'm telling you it's wrong to hate. Now, there's lots of rabbis that said it's wrong to hate. The difference is Jesus is setting himself up as the interpreter of the law. He is the oral law, if you will. I will tell you how the law works. Only the Messiah can do that. He has set himself up to be in opposition of every other rabbi. Now, remember they had hedged the law in with all these other laws. I just want to mention how strict and how the arguments could go. And we have to be careful not to be too harsh on them. Remember, they're waiting for the Messiah. They had 400 years earlier come out of, well, it was before that, but they had 500 years or so earlier. They'd come out of captivity. And then, you know, Malachi, 400 years later, is saying, you're going right back into disobeying God. And then the Greeks show up. Then they overthrow the Greeks with the Maccabees. That's an interesting story, too. They actually overthrow the Greeks. And they gain independence. And it's like, see, God has saved us. And then the Romans show up. It's like, but we're doing everything right now. Why are you letting this happen? Ah, the Messiah is coming. Okay? It's all being fulfilled. This is the oppression, you know, the day of the Lord's coming. And so they had put that all together. The Sabbath itself, the hedge in the Sabbath became really, really important because Gentiles were expected to keep all the other laws, but the Sabbath was just for them. That's how they saw that. It was theirs. So, you know, Gentiles shouldn't kill and steal, and they shouldn't take God's name in vain, and they shouldn't worship idols. But boy, the Sabbath is for us. Because what does it say in the Old Testament? It is a sign between me and you. That's what he told them. So you don't want to break the Sabbath. So you have the Sabbath day journey, which is about a quarter of a mile. You can't walk more than a quarter of a mile. You know, you can't make any kind of fire, although that's not exactly what that means. Even modern day Jews, many of them say that's not what that means. Some still do. You know, there are many Jews today, the Orthodox Jews, the extreme conservative Jews, that will not drive a car on the Sabbath. Not because it's work, but because it's a combustion engine. And because there's fire. You know, those pistons go up and down. There's an explosion that causes those things to happen. That's fire. That's kindling a fire on the Sabbath. It is a sin to drive a car on the Sabbath because that's a kindling of fire. We protect the Sabbath. We hedge it in. When the Messiah comes back, he's going to look for people keeping the Sabbath. So the arguments over the Sabbath that were contained in the oral law, and some of them are now in the Talmud, are, you know, if you throw something in the air and catch it, is that work on the Sabbath? Some said yes. Someone said, okay, no, okay, this gets recorded after a while. Someone said, okay, what if I throw a grape in the air and catch it with my mouth? Because eating is work, but eating is part of the work that's allowed on the Sabbath. Well, then you could do that. But if you throw it and catch it with the other hand, or you throw it and can't get it in your mouth and falls on the ground, you can't pick it up because now you're working. If a woman looks at, there was lots of ones about women. If a woman looks into a mirror on the Sabbath, she shouldn't. Because if a woman looks into a mirror on the Sabbath, she may see a stray hair or a gray hair. So, oh, and pull it out. That's work on the Sabbath. Can't pull out a hair on the Sabbath. Now, in all honesty, it doesn't appear most Jews tried to live by this, but some of them did. And some of them lived by some of them. I mean, the Sabbath day journey was real important. It was really, tried to be kept during the time of Jesus. Remember Jesus is walking through a field and they're picking some grain? It's like, kill the man. He's breaking the Sabbath. The Messiah won't come back. He's breaking the Sabbath. He's picking grain because you weren't allowed to harvest on the Sabbath, which is true. We shouldn't go out and harvest on the Sabbath. By picking raw grain, are you not harvesting? If I have a tomato out in my garden and I go pick that tomato on the Sabbath, am I not harvesting? You say, well, you shouldn't harvest on the Sabbath. We all agree you shouldn't get on your tractor. In that case, you shouldn't get on your, you know, your donkey and go out and harvest. You shouldn't go out and pull all your, well, they didn't have tomatoes, but you shouldn't go out and pull all your grapes, right? You shouldn't go out and harvest your grapes. But what if you go and cut off one little clump to eat? Ah, some said it was okay, some said it wasn't. Because it's still harvesting. They argued, should you send a letter on Wednesday? Because, you know, if you're sending a letter from Jerusalem to Caesarea, it can take 4 days to get there, which means it would be delivered on the Sabbath. I don't know how you would send a letter outside of Judea, Because it could take months for a letter to get any place in the Roman Empire. And they had to be moved on the Sabbath. So I don't know. Maybe they didn't send letters. They had all kinds of problems they couldn't fix. Because the postman is delivering mail, and if he's carrying your letter, he's working for you. Therefore, you have broken the Sabbath. They wanted to make sure they hedged in the Sabbath. And this is why Jesus is constantly being accused for breaking the Sabbath. And usually all he's doing is walking along, taking some grain, or he's healing people on the Sabbath. Because the fear is, the Sabbath is our sign. If this sign gets broken, this Messiah won't come back. He won't come back to save us. So this is very important how these things come together. Now, Jesus then sits down with his disciples and says, I'm going to build my what? Ecclesia. Remember what the ecclesia was? It was the assembly in Athens. All the citizens came together. So when he says, I'm going to create my ecclesia, or how it, he wouldn't have said it in Greek, by the way. He would have said in Aramaic. The New Testament is written in Greek. He spoke Aramaic. But the word ecclesia is used, which means all the citizens of God's kingdom will come together. I will build my citizens. I will build my assembly. That's why assembling together on the Sabbath is commanded. And we do have to, by the way, we can be the opposite of these rabbis who took the Sabbath and made it, you know, just destroyed its meaning, trying to hedge it in. We can't take the Sabbath and do the opposite to it. We can make it just like any other day, except it's the day we go to church on. That's not keeping the Sabbath either. So, you know, once again, we can be pretty hard on these people. But we have to realize we wrestle with some of the same things. You and I wrestle with things all the time that they never wrestled with. Modern things, like driving 40 miles to church. They would be appalled at that. That's work. You get in a car and you drive and you're in traffic and there's stress and there's lights and you're honking. That's work on the Sabbath. How can you do that? So if you went back to the first century Christians would consider us Sabbath breakers because we drive cars on the Sabbath. We don't consider that because in our modern world, we don't consider that work. The air conditioning's on, you're listening to music, you're talking to people. Okay. But they would have. So we have our issues that we have to deal with. We have sort of our interpretation, which is our oral law. There has to be some oral law, by the way. And we know there's oral law that was given to Israel that's not written down. Proof? How many months are there in the Hebrew calendar? And what are their names? Well, it's easy. Just type it, just Google Hebrew calendar. You have all the names and you will have, you know, how many months there are. You won't find that in the Bible. There's only enough in the Bible to sort of piece together a calendar. The Hebrew calendar is not in the Bible. The Jews say it was given to the Levites. We've had it for thousands of years. We believe what they're telling is true. See, the oral law wasn't entirely bad. God gave them things he didn't give us that are there, that those people had. Okay, so this is the world Jesus comes into, and this is the world in which he creates his church. Now, all we've done so far, you know, first three classes, we're setting up the culture in which the church is born. So Jesus dies, he's resurrected, and they believe he's the Messiah. By the way, in your book, pages 74 and 75, this is a good Bible study. This is where in the New Testament, you will find New Testament writers take Old Testament prophecies about the Messiah and use it to prove that Jesus is the Messiah. Jews today will look at this and say, the New Testament writers are just scamming people. Those verses aren't about Jesus. They're about the Messiah who's yet to come. The Jews are still waiting for the Messiah to come. To say it's about Jesus, they think is a joke. Jesus was just another rabbi. Sort of liberal, but you know, good rabbi. That's how they see him. And a little bit crazy to say he was the Messiah, but, you know, rabbis tend to do that sometimes. So, it's a good Bible study. It'll show you how the New Testament, the church began to say, no, Jesus is the Messiah. And how did they prove it? There was no New Testament. You know, the first books of what we call the New Testament weren't written until about 20 years after Jesus died. There wasn't a complete New Testament until after all the apostles died. Paul never had the book of Revelation. He died long before it was written. So there was no New Testament as we know it. They started to collect them. But we have to understand, the New Testament, for the most part, the Gospels were, here's the story of Jesus. They were biographies. Most of the rest of the New Testament are letters. Now, the book of Acts was written because Luke wanted to show his Gentile friends, here's the history of the church that I'm part of. The rest of them are letters. You know, when you write a letter, sometimes you're not very exact in what you say because, you know, you don't think anybody's going to read it except the people you send it to. Paul didn't seem to have any idea that some of the letters he was sent out were going to go to all kinds of people. He wrote us a letter to Corinth. We call 1 Corinthians. It's not the first letter he wrote to Corinth. You know how we know that? He mentions another letter. And why did he write 1 Corinthians? Because they sent him a letter asking some questions. You know what makes 1 Corinthians hard? We don't know what the questions are. We only know what the answers are. As you wrote, here's my answer. And then he gives an answer. It'd help us if we knew what the question was. They're letters. These are real letters between people. And God says, oh, that's good. We'll keep that. Well, he's inspiring them. Okay, but we're going to keep that. We're going to keep that. There's letters that they wrote in the New Testament. We know they don't have. We know they don't have the first letter that Paul wrote to the Corinthians. God didn't keep it. There's a letter mentioned in Colossians where he says, now I wrote a letter, Paul says, to the Laodiceans. You read that letter too. The letter to the Laodiceans was not kept by God and put it in the New Testament. I don't know why. He just didn't keep it. Maybe Paul was rambling on about something. You know, I'm not going to inspire that. Paul's in a bad mood. We won't put that one in there, okay? But he didn't choose to keep it. So these are real letters between people. And Paul can be brilliant. He argues like a Platonic. He does. He argues like a Platonic philosopher. The shadows. Christ is a shadow. What does that mean? Well, in Plato's writings, truth was a reality, but all we usually saw was the shadows. It's called the Allegory of the Cave. It is one of the few things by Plato I would suggest you read. And then there's other places he argues like a rabbi. I mean, it is pure Jewish argument. And then there's other places where Paul pours out his emotions. Oh, what wretched man I am. And then there's other places where Paul argues things like nobody else had ever argued before because God is inspiring him to say something new. He's a very complicated guy. And only Paul could do what God had him do. Let's take the gospel all over the Roman Empire, which he did. So they start the church. Jesus dies. He's resurrected. There's some amazing things that happen. In Jerusalem, there's 3,000 people baptized in one day. Enormous growth. They start in Jerusalem. They go to Judea because he said, Jesus said, you're going to go from Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and then off to the world. That's pretty tough for 11 guys. With no resources, not one of you have any political clout. You are not famous for anything except following the rabbi that they killed. And you're told, yep, you guys, pick a number one, so there's 12 of you. And you guys, you know, after I die, you know, so you got to be 12. So they picked a 12th. You guys are going to go out, talk to the whole world. How in the world are we supposed to do that? Well, you walk. They walked the world or rode a horse or, you know, got a ride on a wagon. There weren't any airplanes or trains or air-conditioned cars. Paul walked into the Areopagus and started preaching. He walked into certain towns, went into the town square and said, okay, and he started preaching, and sometimes they stoned him. We think we have it hard preaching the gospel today. Man, this is easy. So they went out and they said, okay, we're disciples of Jesus. We got to make more disciples. And then you have something very interesting in Acts 7. Verse 1. And this begins to help us understand some of the difficulties they would have in the early New Testament church. Acts 6, verse 1. Now, in those days, when the number of the disciples was multiplying, there rose a complaint against the Hebrews by the Hellenists. Who are the Hellenists? We talked about Hellenes and Hellenization and Hellenists yesterday. Who are the Hellenists? Hellenist means Greek. But this can't be an argument between Hebrews and Greeks. Because in the context, they're in Jerusalem, the church had just started, and almost everybody is Jewish. There's a few what they call proselytes. We'll talk about proselytes later, which are Jews who had already converted to Judaism. So the problem they have here are Jews who speak Hebrew and follow probably the oral traditions more strictly, and they're part of the church. And we have Jews who speak Greek and follow some Greek culture. And there's all the within just weeks, okay, of the church being formed, you have the first division in the church and the first arguing going on in the church. And that is, you know what? We're Greek speakers, and all the Hebrew speakers take care of their widows, and nobody takes care of the Greek widows. Well, they weren't Greeks. They were Jews. In other words, this isn't a split between Gentiles and Jews. This is a split between Jews and Jews over cultural issues. And the apostles say, there's a simple way to do this. We're going to ordain men to fix the problem, to take care of widows. And they did. They ordained seven men and said, you guys, go fix this problem. And they did. And the division stopped. The issue here is culture. What is considered a very strict, protected Jewish culture, so the Messiah come back, any sort of liberal Greeks, they go to public baths. Only, I mean, they go to the ones where you get dressed. Okay, maybe not the naked ones, but they go to the public baths and they wear their gowns, but still. They go to public baths. They've actually been known to go to a Greek play. How dare they do that? You have a cultural issue here. And it comes down to that the Hebrew-speaking Jews aren't really taking care of the Greek-speaking widows. They must see them as inferior Christians. But they're all Jews, they're all Christians. We're going to find this problem over and over again throughout the church. The church is going to have its problems because of real heresy, and the church is going to have its problems because of made-up heresy. Made-up issues that aren't to divide the people of God. They're not supposed to. And then there's going to be real issues. And the issue I want to talk about today that's really important is an issue of the first real heresy they had to deal with. It would have long-reaching effects on the church. As time went on, they became known as Christians. They weren't called Christians. At first, they were just called the followers of Jesus. Oh yeah, they're the followers of Jesus. Eventually, they become known as Christians. Which, you know what the Christian means? Follower of Christ. Okay. So they were always, these are the people, the follower of the Messiah. Okay. They're the followers of that Jewish Messiah. So they're the followers of Jesus. The church eventually spread into Samaria. Jesus said, Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, the world. Samaria is very important because it's the first time now the church is reaching out to non-Jews. You think, well, Samaria is part of Judea, you know. To the Romans, they would have been Jews, but they weren't Jews. Let's go back to 1 Kings 12. Remember what happens about 930 BC, where Israel and, you know, Solomon dies, and then Israel and Judah split into two countries, two nations, right? So what you have is the Jews, the Benjamites, the Vegemites. Okay, I just want to see if you're awake. And the Levites. And they form one country. The rest of Israel forms another country. Now, they have a problem, though, is that they're all the same religion. And that religion demands that certain times during the year, everybody goes to the temple. Where's the temple? It's in Jerusalem. So we have this split, and we have the solution to a problem. 1 Kings 12, let me get there. 1 Kings 12, verse 26. Then Jeroboam built Shechem in the mountains of Ephraim. Jeroboam is the king of Israel. And dwelt there, and he went out from there and built Penuel. And Jeroboam said in his heart, now the kingdom may return to the house of David if these people go up and offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem. Then the heart of this people will turn back to their lord Rehoboam, king of Judah, and they will kill me and go back to Rehoboam, king of Judah. So what did he do? He didn't give up the worship of Yahweh. He didn't give up the worship of Yahweh. He changed the way he was worshiped. He built two golden calves, a house of worship, and said, during the holy days, you come here. He even changed the dates of the Feast of Tabernacles. If you were lived in Samaria and you were of the house of Israel, you kept the Sabbath. You still believed in the Ten Commandments. But you had a different way of doing it than what God told. He made priests that weren't Levites. So he creates a false religion in Samaria. Now, this false religion kept going on. They never returned. If you would ask an Israelite, do you believe in the God of Israel? Yes. Do you believe in the Ten Commandments? Yes. Do you keep the Sabbath? Yes. We go up and sacrifice in Samaria in front of two golden calves that represent whatever they thought it represented. But the Jews down there, they keep the Feast of Tabernacles in the wrong time. We keep it at the right time. And so they mix this pagan, these pagan ideas in, but they still worship God. So imagine how shocked they were. As time went on, they began to mix more and more paganism in. And you know, remember, in the ancient world, you didn't have to believe that the other gods weren't there. You just believed your God was bigger and badder and best. You could believe in Yahweh and believe in other gods. At least you could in Israel. It just, Yahweh was the great God. There might be other gods, but Yahweh was the great God. The Assyrians come in and they destroy Israel. Most of the Israelites leave. There's a few scattered people left. So now they have a big open land. Does anybody know the story? Did you cover this of what the Assyrians did in any class? What did they do? I'm sure there's probably had been, you went through 1st, 2nd Kings, right? So you remember what he did, what they did? John.
They moved in other people that they had conquered.
They moved in other people that they conquered. This was typical Assyria. Assyria was like, pay us taxes. No. Then we come in and beat you up. Pay us taxes. No. Well, we come in and beat you up again. The third time, it was like, we're moving you. And they literally moved you to another part of the world. And these people over here wouldn't pay their taxes, so they moved them there. And one of the reasons why is it removed people from their God. The idea of local gods. So he moves in these other people. If you read the account, these other people move in, and they make Samaria the capital of the area that had been ancient Israel. And they keep getting attacked by lions. They have a lion infestation. I mean, they're just lions all over the place. So you know what they decide? The God of Israel is mad at them. Because they're all worshiping their other gods. So they go find some Israelites that have been scattered around and say, how do we worship your God? So they gave him some priests. Now remember, these aren't Levites. They're wrong priests to begin with. So these wrong priests that have a false religion that Israel had formed come in and teach all the people that were moved into Samaria, here's how you worship the God of Israel. And it says they didn't give up their gods, but they worship the God of Israel. But they didn't give up their gods. Of course they didn't. You might be somebody who believes in 100 gods. You might believe in ancestral gods. Like, well, your grandfather died and he was a good man, so he's now a god. I have to pray to him too. There was a lot of ancestral worship. You know, my dad died. I have to worship him too. But when I'm here in Israel, guess who has more power than anybody in Israel? The God of Israel. So we got to make sure we make him happy. Hundreds of years later, the Jews can't stand to interact with the Samaritans because the Samaritans are not Jews. But they say they are. And they say they're the worship of the God of Israel. But they don't. Oh, they call him Yahweh, but it's a mixture of all these different religions thrown together. Syncretation. Syncretation is the mixture of religions, and this is what we're really going to get into in the second, third centuries. Here we have a people that have already done that. They've mixed all these religions together. Jesus goes to Samaria, and he talks to a Samaritan woman. And she says, yeah, the Jews, they worship down here, but we worship here on this mountain. We worship God. She would have met Yahweh. Probably might have even said Yahweh at that time. We worship God. They worship in the wrong place. And Jesus talks to her, and then she says, oh, you're a prophet. Yeah, he says, yes, I am, basically. She actually accepted him as a prophet. Many Samaritans accepted Jesus as a prophet. So Jesus, as a man from God, maybe not the Messiah, but as a man from God, became part of their culture. So they send Philip, after, you know, the apostles, early in the church. It's in the 30s AD. It's not long after Jesus died. They send Philip down there to preach to those people. He goes down and says, hey, Jesus is the actual Messiah. And large numbers of people. Now, you've been through the book of Acts, right? So you've been through this. Large number of people do what? Convert. And they get baptized. So you know the story. But he doesn't lay hands on them. And the apostles come down, and who do they run into? Simon the magician, or Simon the sorcerer, Simon Magus. Did you read through that? Did you cover that? This man was going to have an impact way beyond this little thing in Acts. He has the syncretized religion that starts way back with a false religion set up by Rehoboam, you know, almost 1,000 years before. Almost 1,000 years before. And now he has this false religion that has been also just has all kinds of pagan elements in it, but they still claim to worship Yahweh. And the leader is a man who has demonic influences. He actually has power from demons. And he becomes a Christian. Now, he doesn't become a Christian by receiving God's Spirit. That's really important. But in a public way, in a way that would look like to other people, he becomes a Christian. Because he's baptized. Baptized into what? Into the body of Christ. Now, he never received God's Spirit, so he's not part of the body of Christ. But in an outward way, he was. So in an outward way, he would claim to be a Christian. This is real important. So, he tries to buy the Holy Spirit and the office of apostle. In English, we have a word called simony. Simony means to buy a religious office. So old simony here even has an impact on the English language, as it comes from him. To buy a religious office. Peter recognized Simon's false conversion, and of course he denies him, won't lay hands on him. And Simon actually asked Peter to intercede for him because with his demonic influences, he can't get to God. So he asked Peter, will you get to God for me? And of course, he rejects him. Now, that's all we have in the Bible. And that's, you think, well, that's not much of a story. Okay, it's sort of interesting. It's not much of a story. But in the second century, we have mention of the descendants, not the descendants, not physical descendants, but people who were still part of a cult, a religion created by Simon. And according to what they write in the second century, Simon ends up in Rome. He goes from Samaria to Rome and builds some kind of little temple and becomes a leader of a new religion. Now, the Romans didn't like new religions. They liked old religions. They liked Jewish religion. They didn't like Christian religion. Christians were okay as long as they were part of Judaism, by the way. It's when the Christians left Judaism that they were persecuted. Yeah, because they were part of an old religion. Ah, you know, we don't like new religions. You can't discover new gods. But Simon shows up and somehow gets a following going. By now he just mixes any kind of religious ideas together, and they become bizarre. Even by pagan standards, it's bizarre. Now, he never seems to have a big group. You don't find him mentioned in pagan sources. You only find him mentioned in Christian sources. Of course, part of the problem is, from the second century, there's more Christian sources that survive than pagan sources. So, but he's not mentioned. He doesn't seem to be a big group, but he's there. And he's a pseudo-Christian group in which he claims he's a god. He claims he's a god. He believes that the world was created by angels. So you can look up and see what Justin Martyr wrote about him and Eusebius. I think Justin Martyr is even quoted in Eusebius' book, History of the Church. Eusebius wrote around 325. Those are the only two sources we have that I really feel are historically accurate. That's my opinion. The Catholic Church, very interestingly, combines all this stuff together. The encyclopedia, the Catholic Encyclopedia, the old ones, have huge sections on Simon, putting all these sources together. But I would say, just go to Eusebius. I think he even quotes Justin Martyr. You'll see what Justin Martyr said. You'll see what Eusebius says. When you put them together, you have what we have now, which is a little bit of what he believed and that this cult existed, which is all we really know. In a minute, I'm going to talk about some conclusions people have come from this, which I don't think we can come to, but I'll talk about that in a minute. So what we get is he believed that the world was created by angels, and he was to be worshipped as some kind of god. He had a wife, which had been a prostitute, and somehow she was divine also, and that the Old Testament was no longer applicable to Christians. Okay, there's other things said about him. It's hard to know what's true, what's not true. But we know that sort of that much. Now, those things aren't strange because, except for worshiping him, those ideas he had are all part of a movement called Gnosticism, which we will talk about in the future. It was part of a group called Gnosticism. Gnosticism was a new religious amalgamation that started to form in the first century and became systematic in the second century. So what I would guess is what Simon taught was craziness, but as Gnosticism formed, his followers became more and more Gnostic because what people claim he taught really fits into Gnostic beliefs. So my opinion is that he created one of the first Gnostic groups. Not as systematic and as intelligent as other Gnostic groups, but it was one of the first Gnostic groups. But we do know he existed. And one of the things that we find very interesting is, well, let me just mention about Gnosticism for a minute, because I don't want to go into great detail, but they believe that there is a huge difference between matter and spirit. Spirit is good and matter is evil. Therefore, your spirit, which is immortal, the mortal soul is good, your body is evil. Now, this is going to take them in some very different ways, okay? Very strange ways. And that the way to get out of this is you have to receive the mysterious gnosis of God. Mysterious knowledge. That's what gnosis. Gnosticism is the people who know the secret knowledge. The secret knowledge of God frees you from the evil body and the evil world and frees your immortal spirit, your immortal soul, to go back to God. And it's a very complicated system, but that's in its essence. That seems to be at least part of what the Simonians believed. So it seems to be that they weren't the major Gnostic group, but they were a small Gnostic group. What's fascinating is they start here in Acts. That's what's interesting. We're finding the first of a group that would form, that would literally, at one point, almost destroy Christianity. They would take over Christianity. There would be a point where almost a majority, most historians believe, of Christians were actually Gnostics. So we're having the beginning of something here. Here's what Eusebius says. Now, this is written about 325. Eusebius is a bishop in the newly formed Catholic Church. Catholic Church formed in the 300s. So he's an important person in this new church called the Catholic Church. I say new church. It took a long time for the Catholic Church to form. Then it officially became known as the Catholic Church. He says, Simon, we are given to understand, was the prime author of every heresy. Their more secret rites, which they claim will so amaze a man when he first hears them, that in their official jargon he will be wonderstruck, or indeed something to wonder at, brimful of frenzy and lunacy, and of such kind that not only that they can't even be put down in writing, they involve such appalling degradation, such unspeakable conduct, that no decent man could be imagined more disgusting than the foulest crime known has been outstripped by the utterly revolting things of these men, who make sport of wretched women, burdened indeed with vices of every kind. I have no idea what they were doing, but Eusebius didn't like it. Okay? You really understand. This man hated it. What's important to understand is that somehow Simon went to Rome, started this little cult that absorbed and developed and became part of a Gnostic movement, so that the Catholic Church almost 300 years later is saying, these are wretched people. Eusebius also says, we have a real problem with them because they keep trying to infiltrate into our church. Well, part of the problems was, we will find out, that what became the Catholic Church had already accepted some Gnostic ideas. They had a few similarities between them and the Simonians. Now, a lot of things weren't similar, but they had enough that there was people, Simonians, and you know, there was this argument within the church that maybe they were partly right, and so you have this movement. You have to understand how absolutely dynamic religious ideas were in the first, second, third, and fourth centuries in the Roman Empire, because freedom of religion was open. Now, have you ever heard, because you asked the question, that Simon was the first pope? I understand where that comes from. There's a problem with it. There is no Catholic Church in the 60s AD. You have to believe a Catholic mythology to believe there was. There was no pope. So if you reject the Catholic mythology, by the way, a lot of good Catholic historians will say Peter couldn't have been the first pope. They even believe he was there because there is nothing, there is no position of pope. There is no universal church. As we're going to show in the second and third centuries, Christianity became hundreds of Christianities. The Catholic Church was an attempt to bring them together, to create one universal church. And in doing so, they just took bits and pieces of all this stuff and mixed it all together. But there was no Catholic Church in the 60s. There was no pope in the 60s. Simon might have called himself, I think he did call himself a father, so he may have been called Papa in Latin. I don't know. But you can't prove he was the first pope. You can prove that for 300 years, his cult existed. It started here. And it would be attacking any true Christians for 300 years. It would be fighting against true Christianity for 300 years. But believe me, they weren't the only Christian group fighting against true Christianity. There was a lot of them. We just find the first one here. We just find the first one. So what happened to him? Now we get into some of the apocryphal and some of the Gnostic writings that try to tell what happened to him. One legend is that he claimed he would show he was a god because he could be buried, and 3 days and three nights later, he would resurrect. Well, they didn't bother to kill him. They just buried him. And 3 days and three nights later, everybody stood around and said, well, okay. That's a pretty gruesome death, but that's part of the legend. The other legend is he would levitate because he had these demonic powers, and he would just sort of fly around. And it's one of the Acts of Peter, which is once again, it's not a biblical book. It was written long after the Bible. It was written in the second century. But in the Acts of Peter, he's levitating and claiming he's a god. Everybody, ooh, ah, you know, in Rome. And Peter's there, and Peter prays, God, show everybody that this guy is not a god. And he plummets to the earth and breaks his leg. And they try to do an operation on him, and he gets gangrene or something, and he dies. Those are the two second century. I mean, there's no proof any of that happened. They're not from reputable sources. They are sort of interesting. I mean, they had to kill off. Okay, even the Gnostics had to kill off Simon. So they had to find a way to let him die a very dramatic, interesting death. You know, and then Peter kills him. I mean, he has him killed by praying, or he just gets himself buried. There were other legends too. Those are the most famous, but. So what happened to him, we don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if he just didn't go insane. But understand, this is important. This little passage in Acts is important. We have the first heretical group form claiming to be Christian, and they are absolutely pagan. Absolutely pagan. And they would end up in Rome and end up creating a cult that existed for at least 300 years. A group that existed for at least 300 years in competition with other Christians, and really including the true Christian church. They would have been in competition with the true Christian church. Okay, any questions about what we covered here? Yeah.
We think that James was the original leader of the Jerusalem Council or something like that?
The reason they believe that Peter was the first pope is Peter does as the disciples. He obviously is the leader of the disciples. He's the one that always speaks first. He's the one that Jesus says, I will build my church on this little rock. No, I am the big rock. You're the little rock. So they have Peter go to Rome and set up the church in Rome. There is no actual proof that Peter ever went to Rome. At best, he traveled through there and probably got killed because there is some historical sources that he probably got killed by Nero. He was killed by Nero. And so he was traveling through there, but if he was the bishop of Rome, the letter written by Paul is absolutely disrespectful. He writes a letter correcting a church and doesn't even talk to their bishop, who is Peter. Boy, that's pretty disrespectful, okay? But by having Peter pass through there, they have him stay there and create the church and become the leader of the new church because they're working, once again, you're working back through history. Rome became, well, just real quick, Rome became the greatest church, the leader of all the churches at one time. Took 300 years, but they got there. So now you've got to work back and prove they're legitimate. By working back, Peter passed through there, which there is some proof maybe he did. Therefore, he started the church there. He's the first leader pope. So all the popes now get their power and authority from Peter. It's passed on from pope to pope. Christ gave this authority to Peter, and whenever the next pope is elected by the cardinals, he receives Peter's power. That's why the pope is so powerful. He sits in the office of Peter. Okay? There is no biblical support for that. And to tell you the truth, there's no historical proof support for it. Because the best is he traveled through and got killed. Okay? That's quite possible. And I personally believe that's probably what happened. But he never started the church there. He wasn't there when they say he's there. I mean, it just doesn't work. Because he couldn't have been there in the 50s because Paul ignores him. So, yeah. They raise him up, and that becomes, by working back through, we got to be careful not to work back through history. By working back through history, they now they create a new narrative which gives them power for 2,000 years. Good Catholic historians will say, it really didn't work out that way. But it's their theology. This is part of their culture. Okay, well, I have to let you go. Keep your questions for next time. We'll see you tomorrow morning.